here's where we ended off last time. We're kind of making a list of some of the issues that often hold us back. I don't think I've ever come across a Christian who said, I don't think God wants me to evangelize. More often, we say, I know God wants me to do it, but there are just a few things that I let get in the way. So what we're beginning to do in this class is make a brief list of some of the issues that often hold us back. And where we ended last Sunday was this idea of an uncomfortable setting. You're at Walmart somewhere, or at the bank, or getting your hair cut, or like me, getting your hair cut at Walmart with a bank next to you, whatever. And there are all these souls everywhere, and it just doesn't feel like the right environment for it. That's something that has held me back, and I think from the comments last Sunday, that's something that can put a lot of us off. Now, before we continue with this list, and we have this great chapter in the Bible we're going to be studying today to bring all this together, I want to kind of digress and say something about what you see behind me. If God expects us to talk about His Son and try to convert people in an uncomfortable setting, how much more so do you think He expects us to do it in a comfortable setting? Can I just ask you, what is the single most comfortable setting in your week for talking about the Bible? You're in it, right? This building is the single most comfortable, confident place where you would be willing to talk to people about your faith and where you worship. You don't have to give them directions. Just say, here. And all the things that are going on with your faith. So here's what I want to talk to you about. There are a few sort of super powerful tools that help in converting people to Christ. And I'm convinced that a local church's strongest evangelistic tool is their church building. When somebody walks into this building who is from this community, maybe it's a family member, a friend, someone new to the community that you've never met before, when they walk into this building and sit down in this pew, we call that fish jumping in the boat. You ever had fish just jump in the boat? That you don't have to fish for them, they just jump in. And they want you to do something with them. That happens, and what is happening in a lot of churches is the fish jump in the boat, we stare at them for an hour, and they jump right back out of the boat. Maybe next week they hop back in to check it out again, you let them hop right back out again, and before you know it, they learn better and they stop hopping in the boat. I don't want to take this imagery too far, but I suspect that behind this curtain there is a live well where you can put those fish. And that changes everything, but we don't often get there, so you are going to hear me mention this just almost weekly for the next 12 weeks. But on the back table, we have these. Anybody recognize this? This is a visitor's card. Someone comes into our building from the community. 100% of those people should be given a card. Every single one. Now, we've tried it 100 different ways back home. We've assigned deacons to the task. We've assigned preachers and elders to the task. But I'll tell you how it works. You've seen somebody you don't know, no matter what your title is or isn't. You go grab a yellow card. You walk over and say, thank you for coming and visiting here. Would you mind filling this out? And the best answer you could possibly receive is, oh yeah, I filled one of those out. 9 people already asked me. That's what we're hoping. 100%. Now, sure, sometimes it's a family member from Colorado who's already a Christian. Those things happen, and that's fine. I tend to make 2 piles on Mondays when I'm piling up the visitors' cards, and that's what we're looking for, a pile of visitors' cards. Now, when you do that, a couple of great things happen. First of all, you go meet these people. You don't wait for a deacon to go meet them. You go meet them. Secondly, you learn a little bit about them, and we'll talk about it as the quarter goes along. You could even get that card and write your name on the back and something you learned about them, which is really advantageous. Now, then it becomes a little bit more my job. My job is going to be on Mondays to sort of make a pile of the local non-Christians who came into our building. And I'll make you a promise. If you can commit to getting 100% of the cards for people who visit, I'll commit that we will contact those people 100% of the time before 7 days is over with. A couple of the coolest stories. I learned more about this from a smaller church outside of Beaumont in Mauriceville, where they were really effective in the community. And they said, a visitor walks in, don't call them, don't email them, don't ask about them. Get in your car on Thursday night at 7 o'clock and go knock on their door. So a friend of mine did that, Benjamin Lee. And as I've told you guys, I think the last time I was here, Ben has bigger arms than me, which made me feel safe any slower. So I felt like double safe going to some stranger's house. So we go to these people's house, they had come to our building, written out a card, submitted it. We didn't know anything about them. We go knock on their door, they invite us in. They practically beg us to come back next week for a study. 4 weeks later, they're Christians. That's been 4 months ago. They're doing fantastically. Their lives changed. You know why? Not because we had any special ability, but because somebody, not even me, somebody got their card, and then we went and we talked to them. So not at all where we're going this morning, except that uncomfortable settings stop us. Fine, we have to work on that. Uncomfortable settings make it really difficult, but let's take real advantage, super advantage, of the power of people who walk into our building and ask to know the truth effectively by their presence. All right? So you'll hear a lot more about that, but there's a pile. Make sure there's always a pile of nice yellow cards in the back. And you have to help me with this, because if I tried this, I would get a lot of, yeah, Chris, I've been a member here for 3 years. Thanks. Because I don't know everybody just yet. But if you see a visitor, help us out with that. All right, let's go back to this. What are some other factors that outside of this church building can often hold us back? Here's something. What if they're just really, really different than us? Socioeconomical differences. Maybe you can tell that this person that you want to invite to services is very, very poor, and all the little sort of bells start going off in your head. Like, if I invite this person, they'll probably want money, and they'll probably need someone to do some things for them. I say, so what? But still, it can kind of slow us down a lot. Maybe they're of a different ethnicity than us, and you just sort of wonder about all the different baggage and barriers that could come along with that. I think probably everyone in this room has been slowed down because what looks like a good opportunity is just someone too different than you. For some of us, they just look too opulent, too rich. Maybe they're dressed really nicely and they have a really fine car, and you're thinking, they don't want to hear this. They moved up to Lindale to retire in the green hills of East Texas. And we let differences than us get in the way. That's one of the factors that can get to us. Here's something else. Maybe you know a little bit about them. They're not some stranger. But you know that they have a really difficult home life. They weren't raised in the church like you. They don't know the morality issues and what the Bible teaches like you do. You know that you would have to start from scratch with these people. In fact, you really have to deprogram them for a couple of weeks before you could even go in and start from scratch. And I'm just wondering if anybody else here has ever thought, I know this person, I really need to try to study with them, but it's like I know too much. Anybody ever been stopped by that? I know too much. I know they're going to ask me about marriage and divorce. I don't have a good answer for their situation. I know that they're going to ask me about why we do things so differently than them, and they just haven't been raised like me. I know that they're going to think that Joan of Arc was Noah's wife. I mean, biblically, we're going to have to start back at square one because they weren't taught like I was taught. That can do it. And sometimes, the more you learn about their poor home life, the more you realize that immorality is a huge issue. Do we live in a culture where immorality is a factor? Sure we do. The divorces that take place around us, you think, oh boy, I really want to sit down and study the truth with them. I'm ready to go. I have my material ready. But I know that marriage is going to come up. And I know that that's not going to work out. Or maybe it's somebody who's not married, but you know that they're living with someone, or they're in a relationship with someone, and you're thinking, they'll never give that up. I've been slowed down by that before, just thinking, you know, there's so far for them to come, I don't know if they can do it. And then lastly, and I think the one that just gets us the most is that, I want to invite them to come on a Sunday night, because I know that they only attend on Sunday mornings at their church, but the guy I want to invite is music knob sound equalizer for the guitar guy. And for that guy to leave that and come here, he would never give that up. Can't tell you how many conversations I've had with people in the denominational world where they feel like when they tell you that, look, I play the piano for our church, and I'm just supposed to back up and leave them alone. Like, that's an impossible change that could never be made, that you would give up playing the piano for your church. Well, I'm here to tell you that has stopped me before. They have their church, we have ours, and I just don't know how we can ever bring it together. Luke, his baseball coach for a few years, was that knob guy, he's the equalizer knob guy, that's why I said all that. And I just thought, that's not my guy. And one day we were in the pool behind his house, kids were playing in the pool, and I was over there, and I just thought, you know, I really need to approach this anyway. And we talked for an hour, and he said things that I didn't think he knew. And he made observations about the direction his church is heading that I never thought I would hear come out of his mouth. And we're still talking. And I nearly had him convinced that he needed to make a change. About 3 weeks ago, we were talking about baptism, and denominationalism and the teaching, and then he called his wife. He phoned a friend, and she turned him around. But we're still working on those things. But what's interesting is I thought it was a dead end. It's not a dead end. So let me just open it up a minute. Have any of these ever been a factor for keeping you quiet? That's my first question. My second question is, can you add anything to this list? Issues that often hold us back. What are your thoughts? Have you been affected by this yet, Josh?
Sometimes if we've known somebody for a long time and we've never talked to them about the gospel before, that's really hard to switch over and start that.
Yeah. What would be a good answer for that? Josh is making an observation that probably applies to a lot of you. Why would you start now? It would seem strange now, after all these months and years, to all of a sudden start inviting people to church. But what are some ways that you can do that effectively? I'm thinking like a gospel meeting. That's special, right? We have a special event, gospel meeting. Yes? His observation is also very powerful. Maybe you've gone months and never talked about the Bible, but they bring up something spiritual. Something's going on, and there it is. Now you have a special reason to engage in the conversation. Maybe if you get a new preacher that uses his hands a lot. And you can say, hey, we've got this new preacher who uses his hands a lot. And maybe you can come check that out. Just use something, anything. Something new, something different. Mr. Ben?
That's what I was going to say. We got a new preacher.
Yeah, something different, something unique. Now, you know that the Bible's still the Bible, and the same truth was here a month ago as is here today, but you're just using conversation starter, conversation piece. Any other comments on, is this a strange list, or is this a list that feels like home for you? This list feels like home for me. I've been here. I have let any one of these issues keep me from introducing Christ into somebody's life. But what would you do if you came across someone who had every one of these problems? Every single problem on this list was apparent in this person's life. What would you do then? Can I tell you what Jesus did? Do you guys remember the day that Jesus came across a woman who possessed every obstacle that you see on the list behind me? I need everyone in the room to open your Bibles to John chapter 4. And let's take a closer look in John 4 at this woman at the Samaritan well. If ever there was a reason to just take a break, pass up an opportunity, and pick it back up tomorrow, Jesus was in that situation. Let's look at this story a bit. I'm in John chapter 4, and let's begin in verse 4. We'll just read a few verses to get started. He left Judea, verse 3, went again into Galilee. So he has to pass through Samaria to get there, verse 4, passes through Samaria. He came to a city of Samaria called Sychar, near the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph, and Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, being wearied from his journey, was sitting thus by the well, and it was about the sixth hour. There came a woman of Samaria to draw water. So what makes this an uncomfortable setting for evangelism? Give me some ideas. Right, same idea. He's not even in a comfortable country or town. Samaria is a place where the Jews and the Samaritans, they've had an issue that's gone back 700 years at that point about some division between them. So he's in an uncomfortable town and region. That's the first thing. What else would make it a little bit uncomfortable for him? All right, we're going to talk about the fact that this is a woman, a Samaritan woman, and a Jewish man. That's doubling down on don't. You're already in a foreign area, and now you have different genders here. Also, it's the end of the day. He's completely worn out. He's been traveling and preaching and teaching all day long. And where are his disciples? Verse 8. They're not even there. How many of you feel power in numbers? Power in numbers is enormous. I just almost can't go knock on somebody's door Thursday night at 7 o'clock by myself. It's just, you know, I'll be the only one running. But you give us two or three of us, and it becomes an unstoppable, confident force in what you're doing. I don't know physiologically, psychologically how that works, but it does. But here, he's by himself. He's in a foreign area, and he's exhausted. This is an uncomfortable setting. Verses 7 and 8, there came a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink," for his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. And in verse 9, therefore the Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask me for a drink, since I am a Samaritan woman?" For, and John adds this for us, Jews have no dealings with Samaritans, whether it's two men or whatever, they don't deal with one another. So that's our second thing. There are enormous socio-economical differences. There's a socio difference because one's a Jew and one's a Samaritan. The fact that it's late in the evening, they're outside the city, this woman is by herself going over to the well. She's probably very poor. She may work out in the fields. No one came to draw water for her. This is someone who may be fairly destitute, really, and impoverished. So there's all these differences that are going on here, and we're mounding up the reasons not to say anything. Now, someone read chapter 4, verses 16 through 18. Chapter 4, verses 16 through 18.
Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come here." The woman answered and said, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You have well said, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and one whom you now have is not your husband, in that you spoke truly."
All right, we're going to need a whiteboard and some color markers here. We've got five guys, five husbands, sixth man, I think. Maybe one of the husbands committed adultery, but the other one didn't. Maybe one. We're gonna need PowerPoint for this to try to figure out this lady's life. Who is she with? Is she married to the guy who she's with? Are they engaged? Can they get married? Should they not? Does she need to go back and record? It's too much. And I would put two of these together here. She wasn't raised very well anyway because she was raised in the north. And a lot of what they taught was very different from what the law of Moses taught. So there's a lot of concepts she probably doesn't even get. And maybe we look at her and think she probably doesn't get anything. You're about to be surprised by that in a minute. But that's what it looks like. And now we have all these potential immorality issues. And it just starts to add up to one conclusion. I only have so much energy to evangelize. This may not be a great place to use my forces. And when we start thinking like that, we make a huge mistake. Yes.
Oh, that doesn't matter. Because when you get down to it and your next words are full of kindness and love, and you say to her, "There's a better way."
Yeah. That's exactly where we're trying to go with this, that none of that matters when there's a better way. Now, she thinks that she has a good concept on that better way already. Look in chapter 4. Still in that chapter, and we get down to verse 20, and I want you to see if you can kind of read her tone into this comment. "Our fathers worship in this mountain," and I'm reading from the New American Standard, by the way. I know there aren't a whole lot of NASBs here yet, but that's where I'm reading. "Our fathers worshiped in this mountain, and you people say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship." She just ended that conversation right there. That's the conversation ender. "Our people worship over here, and you people," when you get a "you people," that's a break right there. "You people worship over there." So look, I get it. You said some things that are really interesting to me, but ultimately there is us and there is you. And that probably would usually be the end of the conversation for most of us. She has every potential problem that we've listed already happening altogether in her life. It looks like a non-starter, but you already know the story. You know that your observation is correct, and Jesus didn't care about any of that. She is in an uncomfortable place. She is different than us. She is the product of a poor home life, immoral choices, and problems with worship. But she also is a living, made in the image of God, valuable to the heart of Jesus' soul. And so he tries anyway. And I guess everybody here understands that that's our only responsibility, right? It's not about how many people you convert, is it? God converts through tender souls, and we're just little tools that sort of facilitate that. The question is, are we trying? Are we willing to try. Let me show you a few things you might find interesting. Go back to the beginning in verses 7, 8, and 9 again. Jesus is in the midst of all of this, and yet he makes an effort anyway. And here's what he finds out. He finds out that she's actually willing to have a conversation with him. Back in verse 7, there came a woman of Samaria to draw water, and Jesus said to her four words. Okay, he didn't say, "You're lost and you need to follow me." None of that. He just said, "Give me a drink." And as a response to that, verse 9, she asks a question. "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask me for a drink since I am a Samaritan woman?" Now that's the response she gave, but give me a couple of ideas on what she could have done. Jewish man to a Samaritan woman in the evening outside of town around a well. "Give me a drink." What could she have done?
Run for her life.
She could have run for her life, all right? That would have been funny, but safe. She could have run for her life. She could have gone over to some Samaritan guys and said, "I think we've got a problem over here." But most likely, what would she have done had she not done this? What do most people do?
She would have walked away.
You just walk away. You just don't. You just don't. You don't answer. You just act like they didn't talk to you, and you just go, or you give some just, I could see her giving just some sort of slight nod and then going, or maybe just give him a drink and walk away really quickly. But here's the thing. He's in the wrong place at the wrong time talking to the wrong person. But she is willing to interact with him. This is a really cool revelation in evangelism if you've had some difficulty with this in the past. I was getting my hair cut the other day at Walmart. This is what I do. I know. And I thought, well, here we go. You know, she had the scissors. All the issues were there. And I just sort of said, you know, "Where do you go to church?" And she was Hispanic. I suspected Catholic from her language. And I was just kind of really interested. And she just came out with it. And she talked about, you know, I told her where I went to church. She talked about she's Catholic and we're not. A lot of that was there. But how she'd been reevaluating, et cetera, and so forth. The point is this. She could have just gone on cutting my hair, not answered. She could have just continued some conversation with the other hairdresser because they talk about really deep issues. But instead, she had a conversation with me. I didn't beg her to do that. Just ask a question. And so sometimes what we find is these people are actually quite willing to interact, but there's more. She was also somewhat inquisitive. Let's go back to the reading again. I want someone to read verses 10, 11, and 12. John 4, 10 through 12.
"Jesus answered and said to her, 'If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, "Give me a drink," you would have asked him, and he would have given you of living water.' The woman said to him, 'Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as well as his sons and his livestock?'"
Okay. What we're going to do, we'll probably run out of time today, but what we'll do next Sunday is I want to go through this and show you just how masterfully Jesus worked this conversation. And I think that's where you'll get the most practical value out of John 4. When you see how he did the bait and switch, did you guys see that? I'll let the cat out of the bag on that. He's talking about water, and he says, "How about living water?" We're already talking about water, so it's not like it's out of nowhere. Now I want to just kind of talk about living water. Now when he sort of jumped up a level in intensity and said, "You know, there's this water that you can drink, and you will never have to draw or get any more. It is living water, this gift of God." What she could have said was, "Look, man, I'm just trying to give you something to drink out of this well. I just want to get this over with." She could have said, "That got weird, that jump. You jumped to something that I'm not ready for." But she didn't. She came back with these questions where she's inquisitive about it. Verse 11, "You have nothing to draw with. The well is deep. How can you get that living water? You don't have living water. Are you greater than our father Jacob?" She's asking great questions. Those aren't good questions. Those are great ones. "What kind of water are you talking about? I don't understand that. And who do you think you are? What do you think you're talking about? Who do you think you are?" Sometimes that would get us to step back and feel like this is about to get argumentative, but she's just inquisitive. She wants to know the answer. Really fascinating thing. When you're just engaging with someone on evangelism, you're talking about, "I go to church at the Lindale Church, and we have Bible classes, and we have this," and they're sort of interacting, and then you just say something bold, and you watch what happens. Usually, that triggers some question, some response. So, here's somebody who looks like a dead end, and yet she's willing to have a conversation. That's the first thing that we notice about her. And she actually wants to know a few things. She's pretty interested in where this might be going. And then we get to verse 19. I would also mention verse 15 for a moment. Give me this water so that I will not thirst nor come all the way here to draw. Well, that's interesting. She's really getting engaged in this a little bit. She is fascinated with what he is talking about. I think we live in a time where we don't think people are fascinated with spiritual things anymore. Can I tell you that in a world that lacks spirituality, spiritual things are actually incredibly fascinating to people. It's like an endangered species or something. You just can't help but photograph and stare at it. That's what spirituality is, and so it sort of draws attention. And then verse 19, the woman said to him, and this is after he said, I know some things about you. You've had five husbands, verse 18. You're with a man now. He's not your husband, and you've been telling me the truth. The woman said to him, sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. What does the word perceive or perception mean? Okay, I understand. Does anybody have another word in verse 19 besides perceive? I suppose. All right. Perceptiveness. We gentlemen may not be able to define this, but the ladies probably have a good idea. Perceptiveness, yes? Say again. Okay. You're able to kind of begin taking the details, and just instantly in your brain, it all starts to kind of come together. She has perceived or supposed, or she's beginning to understand that he's a prophet. You know, you look at her and think, she knows nothing, and she's probably not really intelligent. Shame on you for that. She's able to ask the great questions. I truly appreciate the questions in verses 11 and 12. She's able to make a bold proclamation in verse 15, and now she perceives verse 19 that this guy is a prophet. Now, she doesn't know half of it yet. He is a prophet. He's more like the prophet. But she knows that something special is happening. But when you see that light go off in the head or in the eyes of people you're talking to about Jesus, be the way you spend the rest of your life, watching people begin to perceive and put it together. But here's the thing that surprises me most. When they start talking about worship a little bit later, Jesus is moving along slowly. We'll talk about that next week. He's being patient with her. You get down to verse 19, and she says that, and in verse 20, our fathers worship over here, and your fathers worship over there, and he gives this great response, sort of staying on topic, that look, it's not about where you worship as much as God is about to establish a kingdom where there are those who worship him in spirit and in truth. Somebody read verse, never thought for a million years this would come out of her mouth. But somebody read verse 25.
The woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming. He is coming called Christ. When the one comes, he will declare all things to us.
I don't even know what knocked me over with a feather means, but you knocked me over with a feather, I guess. How does she know this? She's not supposed to know about this. She knows about the Messiah. She is a Samaritan. She does not worship in Jerusalem. She has not even perhaps ever been to the temple and heard the text read. She is worshiping over there on that mountain and probably mixing it with false offerings. And yet she knows that the Messiah is coming. How does she know that? I don't know, but I know she's a lot smarter than she looked. She's a lot more spiritually minded than most of us would have assumed at first glance. In fact, she's quite intelligent when it comes to spiritual things. This is the great revelation that I had sitting in the backyard at my friend's house while the kids were swimming in the pool. This guy knows a lot about the Bible. And he knows a lot about the truth, and he knows enough to know that he may need to go back and reevaluate it again. I didn't know all that, but he's intelligent. Let's not quickly assume we know stuff and nobody else does, so to try to teach them would just be like starting with kindergartners. You will be surprised that spiritually minded, truth-knowing people out there in the world who are just a little bit misguided and have missed a few key authority points or just waiting for somebody to help straighten them out. That's what's happening here. And that brings us to the best observation of it all, and that's verses 28. Can someone read verses 28, 29, and 30, please?
So the woman left her water pot and went into the city and said to the men, come see a man who told me all the things that I have done. This not the Christ, is it? They went out of the city and were coming to him.
All right, so her response is she is responsive. She's getting it. She's impressed. She knows that something amazing is happening. And by the way, we'll talk about this next week, but his hook here was to announce that he was that Messiah. I will just tell you, don't try that when doing your hook. That will not work for you. But for him, that's what he had. What he had was, I am the one you've been waiting for. Now, she has to do something with that. You have two choices, I guess. You can forget you just heard that or decide you don't believe that and you can leave. Or you can believe it and go to town and get as many people together as you possibly can and go back out there and learn the truth. That's what she did. Responsive. What looked like a lost cause ended up being an entire village of disciples. I don't know this for sure, but I wondered if this was the same village or area where the Sons of Thunder, you guys know those guys, right? James and John, when they traveled through Samaria earlier, said, Jesus, would you like us to call down thunder and lightning from heaven and just consume this village? I see the look on Jesus' face. Is it possible that they're back in that village, that that's one of their stopping places? And a village that most would have counted for loss, and two apostles wanted to consume with electricity, became a disciple woman who went and brought others out. And in verse 39, from that city, many of the Samaritans believed in him. Because of the word of the woman who testified, he told me all the things that I had done. She was impressed. He used a miracle. He told her about her life, and it impressed her. And many were saved because of that. Miss Ann Stevens, I was talking to Josh about this at his house the other night. Miss Ann Stevens was here on Wednesday night, and she wrote this song, Who Can Count the Apples in a Seed? I think it's been led here a time or two. I love that idea, the idea of you plant one seed in ground that looks like it's just hard and impossible, but you plant the seed there anyway, and out of one seed, how many apples are produced? Countless apples. One seed makes one tree makes many apples, each apple produces its own seeds, and you can see where that can go. I preached in Mauriceville, 2005-2007. And there were two rows right here completely filled with people. Both the rows. I mean, just 10, 8 on each row. 5 years before that, I wasn't a part of this, but there's one high school girl that sits right there. And none of these people were Christians. But another high school girl who sits with her family over here at school one day invited that girl to just come and see. That was what the Samaritan woman said, right? Just come and see. She came and she saw and she became a Christian. Her name is Jerry Linscomb. She became a Christian. And so what do you think she did? She told her mom and dad, you need to come check this out. And her mom and dad became Christians. And what did they do? They told their parents, you need to come check this out. And her grandma and grandpa became Christians. And then she told her sister, you need to come check this out. Her sister and her sister's husband, whom I married actually, they became Jennifer and Chris. They became Christians. And then Uncle Bob. You know, everybody's got like the uncle who just kind of like plays the guitar well, and just sort of meanders out here looking for an answer. They invited, and he plays it very well, actually. They invited him to come. He became Bubba, perfect. Bubba Moe became a Christian, and you have all of these apples, you know. One little seed. High school kids don't invite high school kids to church, right? I mean, you're at school where everything you do gets judged. And you can't have spiritual conversations at school, and there's all these things that hold them back. All I know is there's an enormous family going to heaven, still talking to other people about the gospel. You can never track how many apples come out of that seed. They're all raising kids now. There's four kids in that family. Oh yeah, Joseph and Jacob, they're teenagers, Christians, because of one invite. You can never count the apples in a seed, but you can very easily count the apples in no seeds. No seed. No apple. Now here's one of the things that we're going to do throughout the rest of this. I want to make it really easy. Just give you some ideas. You won't like all my ideas over this quarter. but give you some really, really easy ways that we can start doing better at this. I think Ben's right. The fact that you have a change in preacher or gospel media or something just gives you some instant ability. But hopefully by next week, I'm going to have some cards I want to show you. And what the challenge will be is everybody takes 5 cards, and within a month, which sounds kind of weak, but it's a great start. It's a great start. 5 cards in a month, you just have a conversation with someone, invite them to the website. We've got a new website coming together. It's really easy to use. Instantly give them the information that can get them to heaven. And we'll start just kind of working that. And then when they come through the door, what do we do? Get information on them. And then before the week is out, what do? We go and we talk to them. And we don't have to save anybody to please God with that. But we will. God will. Results will be there. So one of the first observations here to make is that this is something that God wants us to do, and this is something that we can do. Any comments or questions so far about this?
One thing I wanted to mention, that if you stop the woman and the woman comes back and says, this could turn on the man. What you say next, or the poor man, and you have to be careful with you. He's like, she's fixing the argument, and you have to be careful. The law magically wants to go into it against the mother.
Sure.
What you say next is really important.
Let's illustrate that. Are you still in John 4? Let's illustrate that in verses 20 and 21. At some point, when people realize you're trying to change them, I'm convinced that that's the hardest thing on the face of the earth to do. Change somebody else. You have to convince them to change themselves. That's the only way that it works. Nobody wants to be changed by anybody else. And so in verse 20, she's identifying that he's different than me. And we've read this already. But she says, our fathers worship in this mountain. You people say in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Now listen to his response. What could he have said? Could have walked away. Could have said, that's right. We're right. You're wrong. You've got to learn to live with that. Which is true, by the way. Here's what he said instead. Woman, believe me. An hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. Verse 22, we worship what we know. For salvation is from the Jews. Now that is a bold statement. Let's be clear. But he set it up well. Believe me. It's not about where you go to church or where I go to church or what your history is or what name is on the sign out front. All it's about is, are we reading, believing, and obeying? Could you tell that to someone? When they say, well, I'm Baptist and you're Church of Christ. I'm not real sure what that means, but it's usually with a little dart on it. I don't know that. And I've said, look, I'm not, and I don't know why you call me that, and that's no studies with any of those people. Here's a better answer. Look, it doesn't matter what we call ourselves. It doesn't matter where we've been or what we're doing. All that matters is let's get in this book together. Let's just read a little bit. Let's just talk a little bit. And let's match up our lives with what the Bible teaches. So here's what we'll do next week. Let's start working a little bit on these. We see some people. Next Sunday, we're going to go back through John 4 for what I consider to be my favorite part. And that is, I want you to see how Jesus did this, the way that he worked with her, because I think you'll find a lot of useful tips. And then after that, we've got some material that I want to give you on what to teach people. So thanks for your attention.